My name is Brandon Reichel. I think I've met most of you by now. And I'm going to talk about some of the work I've been doing on ocean surface boundary layer parameterization. This has been largely part of my postdoc work at GFDL. And it's been work I've been doing with Bob Hallberg, Steve Griffiths, and Alistair Adcroft. And this is kind of a nice picture I stole from Steve, took out on a cruise in the Southern Ocean last year. Just to give you a flavor of the region we're looking at. So this is the, I think, 8 meter waves or something like that. So it tells you kind of how intense and energetic this region is. And this is kind of what we're largely dealing with. So the topics I'm going to cover today, I'm going to start with a bit of an overview of some ocean surface boundary layer parameterizations. And then I'm going to talk about our new, I call it a framework or parameterization framework that we're using for boundary layer mixing and climate models called EPBL. And then hopefully at the end, I'll have plenty of time to get into some of the work that I've been doing with adding a Langmuir turbulence parameterization into the EPBL framework. So the primary motivation for this work, I think, hopefully with an audience like this, is pretty obvious. We know that the boundary layer is critical for simulating coupled atmosphere ocean processes. So we know the air sea flux is basically how the atmosphere and the ocean are actually talking to each other. The depth of the mixed layer is what's going to determine the response of the ocean to variable atmospheric forcing. So if the mixed layer is deep, then it's going to take the ocean a long time to change when you have different atmospheric conditions above, where if it's shallow, it'll adjust much quicker. And then you also have to consider the boundary layer depth, which is basically the region of the strong turbulence and mixing. And so when the boundary layer depth is deeper than the mixed layer depth, that's when you get a lot of, that's when you get entrainment and strong diapicnal mixing, and the boundary and the mixed layer can get deeper that way. And that's what makes the boundary layer unique from the ocean interior, where you have much weaker cross-isopycnal mixing. And so in this figure here, I'm kind of trying to summarize kind of all the physics that we're trying to capture in these boundary layer parameterizations. And so you basically have kind of four leading order sources of turbulence. And a couple of these are actually common between the ocean and the atmosphere. So if you prefer to think about things in the atmospheric sense, you can just kind of invert this figure for those. And that's the convective instability, which is basically the release of energy when you have just basically heavy water sinking down into light water, overshooting its neutral level and ultimately producing turbulence. Shear instabilities, so basically Kelvin-Helmholtz types are associated with small Richardson numbers. And then in the ocean, we also have wave breaking at the surface and Langmuir turbulence due to the Stokes drift associated with surface waves. And these four processes kind of produce the turbulent kinetic energy in the boundary layer. And you can have processes which basically redistribute that, but in an integral sense, where that's going to go is it's either going to go to increasing the amount of energy you have, dissipation, or into this mixing term, which is basically when you're increasing the potential energy of the water column by making stable stratification and making it towards neutral stratification.
Go back. So schematically, I don't know if this is true in reality, but the way you show the shear, the dominant shear, mean shear, is at the same place as the sort of the dominant convection, whereas in the atmosphere, mean shear is sort of at the surface and convection dominates above. Are they coincident or are they separated?
So, I mean, this is more supposed to be cartoon. I'm not necessarily trying to say anything about the scales where these occur. So you can have shear certainly at the surface when you have the wind-driven currents. And then you'll also have a lot of shear at the base of the mixed layer.
And you'll have a lot of shear in the middle, too.
Well, in the atmosphere, the shear is always, almost always, highest at the surface for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
No slip.
And that's kind of the top of the boundary layer you tend to have a lot when you have strong wind forcing in the bottom of the boundary layer.
Right.
But that's not the dominant shear instability, the very near surface shear instability in the ocean cases.
So then when we want to actually parameterize this turbulence for using a model, we can look at kind of the suite of parameterizations that are presented in the literature and discover that there's a lot of options for how you can do this. And so one of the questions that you're going to have then is, which parameterization should I be using and why? And so I think kind of the three biggest considerations outside of course, you want to have a parameterization that you think is adequately representing physics, is how well will your parameterization behave with your Colling model. And so you need to consider things like the vertical grid. So if your vertical grid is isopycnal, you're kind of limited to using a bulk type mix layer. I'll talk a little bit about those in a couple slides. Is the grid resolution going to be sufficient to resolve these shear and buoyancy profiles that you might need in some of these other parameterizations that take that into account? Is the time step of the Colling model sufficient to resolve the processes you're trying to get? So if your parameterization considers non-steady state turbulent kinetic energy, then you need to have time steps short enough to resolve the time scale it takes the turbulence to adjust to the mean flow, which can be on the order of hours in the ocean. And then, of course, computational constraints are important. So particularly when we're talking about climate models, you don't want your turbulence parameterization in the ocean to be a bottleneck of the model. So you want to make sure you have something simple enough to basically solve quickly as you're stepping through your dynamics. And so I'm going to highlight three particular models that are pretty common in the next couple slides. One of these is the Krauss-Turner type models. These are the bulk mix layer where you basically integrate over your boundary layer and treat it as a slab. And then there's KPP, which is it has the vertical profile, but it's treated in a more kind of empirical way. And then there's the two equation model. I'm going to focus on K epsilon. If you prefer Miller-Yamada or K omega or the generic length scale, I think that the discussion today is going to be general enough that it's applicable to any kind of two equation model.
Are you suggesting the other models are not empirical?
Well, there are empirical coefficients in all of them, of course.
They're all empirical.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did not include DNS in here. So the bulk type models, so I'm going to go through a couple examples where I'm going to be talking about things in terms of buoyancy. Of course, we can do these for temperature and salinity separately. This is just to kind of make the conversation simple. So if we have, in the bulk model, basically you have to represent the buoyancy as completely homogeneous in the boundary layer. And so you would have basically a buoyancy discontinuity then at the bottom of the boundary layer over the stably stratified kind of thermocline and interior region. And so if your buoyancy equation, at least the vertical mixing component of it, then is going to be the time rate of change due to the convergence of the buoyancy flux. You can integrate over this when your buoyancy is constant. And so this derivative falls out and you're only concerned about the top and the bottom boundary condition then. So basically the top boundary condition is either kind of prescribed or solved for from the transfer coefficients. And the question then is, how do you get the bottom boundary condition? And that's treated with kind of this so-called jump approximation of the entrainment flux, where you basically take an entrainment velocity scale times the change in buoyancy at the base of the mix layer. And so this is basically an energy effect, because basically if you're moving buoyancy into or out of the boundary layer, you're going to be changing the potential energy. So this has been often approached by integrating the turbulent kinetic energy equation for the boundary layer. And in that case, you can come up with a form for the entrainment velocity where, so I call this mixing, which is basically the taking up of density into the mix layer. And there's a mechanical term here, which is represented with this coefficient m star times u star cubed, and then a buoyancy term here, which is the surface buoyancy flux times some coefficient n star, which is basically kind of the efficiency of the buoyancy release in the water column that actually then is available to go to potential energy and not be dissipated. And so this, the grid sensitivity for these are used for the isopycnal models for the most part. There's not really time step constraints, so you don't need to resolve turbulent timescales. But obviously, a lot of this work you can see happened in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, so people haven't really been working with them lately because of the weakness of the homogeneous boundary layer.
You don't have to assume that the vertical stratification is a constant, that the B is constant. You're just only solving for the vertical integral of B.
That's true.
And maybe as a comment, I think it's a bit unfair that these models are not used. They're not used in the large-scale ocean models, but PWP, Pricewaller, and Pinkel is the observational community is using them extensively to interpret observations, at least.
So there's a reason that I'm presenting this like this, and this is going to come back to be kind of a theme of the parameterization I'm going to present later.
So I'm not familiar with these different types of parameterizations, so I'm going to ask some very basic questions. So
please,
can you explain what are the inputs and what are the outputs?
So basically, what you're considering. Sorry, I should have backed up a little bit. In a model like this is the forcing at the surface, so things like the wind stress and the buoyancy flux.
So is that like the U star? And
yes, the U star squared is the wind stress. And then B naught here is the buoyancy flux. BSW is kind of so that's a short wave penetrating solar radiation term.
So those are both inputs to this model.
Yeah, so this model would consider basically those quantities, and then it, of course, would need to know about the background buoyancy profile. And what it's basically predicting is how your boundary layer depth then will change in time to give you that homogeneous.
Okay. So you're trying to predict H, capital H.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right, where that would be then the thickness of this layer.
Okay, so again, just so that I understand this, because it's I'm not familiar. So the idea is that you have as an input, you have the U star, the B naught, B S W. Use that to solve for W E, and that the capital E is the same thing as W little e. Is that right? The jump approximation.
Yes.
Do I have a capital W? It's
E is capital.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Yes, that should be the same.
That gives you the W prime.
That gives you the buoyancy flux at the bottom of the boundary layer.
Okay, there. And then you put that into the next equation above, and do you know W prime B naught?
So that you would assume that you know based on like the atmospheric.
Okay, so that's another model. And then, that's another input, and then from that you get the time derivative of that, which
how the,
gives you the height.
Yeah, how the buoyancy, the integrated buoyancy of the boundary layer is going to change in time.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I guess the major weakness of this in this sense here is that we know that there's important physics associated with vertical velocity structure in the boundary layer. And there's also important things for the biology, so we want to be able to get that structure. And also the restratification in this framework can be a bit of a problem. So then I'm going to talk about a couple of other models that use a bit of a different approach, which is by basically prescribing an eddy viscosity approach throughout the boundary layer to do the mixing. And so in this case, you come up with your buoyancy equation where your buoyancy flux is parameterized from a down gradient mixing with, this is the eddy viscosity term here. And then you can also have a non-local flux, which is kind of a big feature of the way that KPP does it. I'm not actually going to talk too much about that, but that's basically just kind of a redistribution of the surface buoyancy flux, which is due to the fact that you can have eddies and processes, particularly in convection, that occur throughout the boundary layer and make it very non-local. For the local part of KPP, the key part of it is diagnosing the boundary layer depth, which is typically done using a Balk-Richardson number approach, where you basically want to say the competition between the shear and the buoyancy. And so when this fraction is small, it means you have a lot of shear and basically little stable buoyancy to work against. And so you'll define basically a critical Richardson number, typically on the order of a quarter. And when this quantity is smaller than that, you're within the boundary layer. And when it reaches that value, that's how you find the depth of the boundary layer. And then you solve for the velocity scale. So without giving the details of it here, it's basically done following the similarity scalings with a couple of little differences. But for the most part, the velocity scale then will be dependent on the wind stress, the surface buoyancy flux, the position in the water column, and the boundary layer depth. And then to get the local mixing coefficient, you just take that boundary layer depth times the velocity scale times a non-dimensional shape function, which I've shown here, where this sigma coordinate shown on the y-axis here is basically the distance you are from 0 being the surface and 1 being the boundary layer depth. And so this can have grid sensitivity when you start to think about how to compute the boundary layer depth, because obviously your reference velocities can only be defined as how well that you have the water column resolved near the surface. But again, you don't need to resolve turbulent timescales, which makes it good for running in models with long time steps. And then the final one I'm going to talk about is like the K-epsilon type model, or the two equation, or basically 1.5 moment or higher order turbulent closure. In that case, this is similar to what KPP is doing, except for they don't typically include that non-local term. The non-local term tends to be thought to be important during convection, but it's not necessarily very clear how to actually deal with it. So oftentimes it's not dealt with, and it's not clear how significant
that is.
Absolutely
essential in convection that you have non-local.
It's
non-gradient flux.
To get the correct relationship between the temperature profile and the buoyancy flux, you definitely need a non-local flux. When you don't have it, you tend to get a different shape of your temperature profile, basically, that compensates for it. And I don't know how important that necessarily is or not. I haven't.
If the profile matters, it's a wrong profile.
If those details of the temperature profile matter, it will be affected negatively. That's right.
I ask, isn't it more fundamental than that? In convection, typically, you should have no DBDZ, so you can't just
So these models typically employ, so if you call it a one equation model, you're basically solving a time step for a turbulent kinetic energy equation. I don't need necessarily for you to understand the details of these equations, just to give you a flavor of what the model's doing is why I'm showing them. For the length scale equation, so here it's given in terms of epsilon. If, again, you like Miller-Yamati, you can use a different length scale equation. And if you're using a one equation model, you might actually use something more algebraic or some other empirical method to come up with a length scale. The velocity scale is basically, or the mixing coefficient is basically turbulent velocity scale times the length scale, where the length scale is found using dimensional relationships between the TKE and the dissipation. And then there's also this kind of coefficient term here, which is often called a stability function, which you can get very empirically from some sort of functions of basically Richardson number, which is basically just relating your turbulent Prandtl number to your Richardson number, so that your turbulent Prandtl number will increase higher Richardson number. Or you can do more advanced methods where you actually then start to consider more of the second moments and so on and so forth. The final parameterization I'm going to talk a little bit about in this kind of motivation is this Jackson et al. Approach. And this is just a shear-driven mixing scheme, which was formulated to try to be able to predict mixing both in the equatorial region at the base of the equatorial undercurrent and also in overflows at high latitudes. So in a lot of previous methods that have kind of attacked this empirically, they've had dimensional coefficients in there that obviously can't be right in both conditions and can't be, not necessarily obviously, but aren't necessarily right in all conditions and can't be universal since they have dimensions. And so what this does is basically it tries to take a much simpler approach to that K epsilon type approach, where you basically assume that the TKE equation is steady state, so you drop off the left-hand side. The length scale equation is simplified to be in terms of the actual eddy mixing coefficient. And so this form of the equation can be rewritten as it is right here. And then this source term here based on the shear goes back to Ellison and Turner paper from the 50s. And these equations, while they're still pretty complicated, they're actually simple enough that they can be solved iteratively in an implicit manner, which is important because it means that this basically takes that last approach but tries to take the time dependence out of it. So it tries to, so the main point, and I skipped over this here, was that this is wrong. You do need to resolve turbulent timescales here. Sorry. And here, the idea is that you hopefully don't need to resolve the turbulent timescales anymore. And so this is just showing you some of the results from that paper where they tuned some of the empirical terms from basically a DNS version of MIT GCM to come up with a parameterization that worked better than the previous version, which was a simpler version of this, but it didn't have this turbulent flux term here, which meant that it couldn't necessarily do entrainment away from the low Richardson number areas. And so now the reason that I've gone through all of that is because I want to show you how these parameterizations do when you start to vary the time step and the grid resolution in your calling model. And so to do this, I'm just showing you a couple very simple experiments where I initialize a 1D model with a constant stratification. And then I just force it with a constant wind stress, and I run the model out for, in these cases, 10 days. And I'm going to run it at a couple different latitudes, so a couple different rotation rates. And we're going to look at how the answers change in the model. And so the black line here is what I'm basically calling like an optimally deployed version of the model, where your grid spacing is 1 meter and your time step is 30 seconds. So you should be resolving all those turbulent processes that you need to get. Climate models, however, tend to use much coarser resolutions. So in the blue line, I didn't vary the time step, but I varied the grid spacing to be 20 meters. And when you consider the fact that an ocean boundary layer typically goes between maybe 20 to 30 meters and a couple hundred meters, this tells you that this is a pretty poor resolution of the boundary layer in terms of space. And then in the red, I just changed the time step. So now we're a 2 hour time step, which is the time step that we actually use in our thermodynamics step of the ocean model we're using at GFEL right now. And then in green is both coarse in the vertical and coarse in the time step. And so this is the simpler K epsilon model, which you can see when the time step's too long, it stops working. This is at the equator again. And the standard K epsilon, you get a similar result. CV mix and this Jackson that was meant to deal with these long time steps both seem to do fine at the equator.
This is
potential energy. So this is the integrated effect of the mixing on the stratification in the water column. So this, I think that this is a quantity that you really want to get right in your turbulence model, because it tells you on the bulk how much mixing you're letting the water column do. Yeah.
Is it a coincidence that the coarse spatial and temporal seems to do better?
I think so, yeah, because it, as you see here, it starts to finally blow up near the end. It's a bit funny, and I don't know exactly why it does that. But the main point here is that these are sensitive to the time step, as basically we expect them to be, because they're trying to resolve that turbulence budget without having the time resolution to resolve the turbulent processes. But then when we move away from the equator, now we start to see problems in all of these models where basically, so these ones were not necessarily that surprised because we knew it was going to suffer with bad time stepping, but also when you stop resolving the vertical grid well at higher latitudes, when your Ekman effects basically shrink the boundary layer, you start to have a fall off in performance. And I'm not comparing these against each other, I'm just comparing these relative to their high resolution cases.
How does rotation come into those equations that you
showed us? So it comes in through the mean flow for...
mean state is different.
Because
you have F there, and I was...
Yeah, so for all of these, it's basically coming in through the U and V and how they feed into the different parameterizations.
And a varying form of KDP that we use in the ROMS model, there is essentially a boundary layer depth limitation associated with that rather than just this simple bulk Richter's movement.
Yeah, and that's why I've made sure to point out this is the CV mix KPP that uses that bulk Richardson approach. But you can see, even though we know that the bulk Richardson number is spatially dependent, when you vary the time step in KPP, it doesn't have that much of an effect, which is to be expected because it was kind of designed for these types of scenarios. And so I can step...
Which one would you believe that if you were asked to... I mean, one of the 1 meters 30 seconds would it be...
So I tend to like this model from how I've seen it compare against large eddy simulations, and I'll come back to that point later. I'm going to use that model then for another purpose. So stepping forward, you can see the results basically fall off even further as you get closer to the North Pole. So the question is now, what do we do if we want to run a climate model? How do we parameterize the mixing? And so now this kind of comes back to this point of, can we still use some of the ideas of Krauss, Turner, Nealer, but can we take some of the better features of models like KPP and come up with something that allows us to have stratification in the water column, but not to have such a high sensitivity to grid resolution and time step and things. And so basically, these equations are equivalent here. Coming out from integrating the turbulent kinetic energy equation. And so in one case, we're trying to predict an entrainment velocity. And in the other case, this is basically your buoyancy flux, but only when it's acting against stable stratification. So you can see there's a maximum on the n squared here. And so this is basically the integral rate of increase of potential energy in the water column. We keep the mechanical term the same. And then we also allow the buoyancy term. So this is, again, you can see that now I'm taking only the unstable stratification. And this is the integral of the released potential energy due to convection multiplied by a fraction n star between 0 and 1 that tells you how much of that convection can then actually go back into mixing against the buoyancy profile. And so the big difference here is that then we go away from the vertical, vertically homogeneous profile to vertically resolved profile. And the kind of some details of how we do that with the mixing coefficient, it's very similar to what KPP is doing, where we have then some sort of empirical shape function. If this term here is 2, then it's pretty much exactly the same as what KPP is doing. And a velocity scale, without going into the details of it too much, it basically scales with U star in a wind-driven boundary layer, and it scales with your, this would basically collapse down to something like the Deardorff velocity scale, or the based on the surface buoyancy flux when you're in convective conditions. So then we take this model, though, and we plug it into our climate model with the traditional values of M star and N star. So obviously those are very important. They control at leading order everything about the energetics. So when we run it with the standard values from the literature, with a small caveat that there is a decay as you go towards the North Pole, which was kind of added empirically in the 90s by Oberhuber. The comparison with observations is not particularly great, especially if we look. So this is the sea surface temperature bias against World Ocean Atlas. This is results from a couple of climate simulation averaged over, I think, about 20 years. And you can see blue means we're too cold, reds and yellows mean we're too warm. Our boundary layer depths are actually reasonable, but obviously we need to think a little bit more about what N star and M star should actually be, and so how much these processes should actually be contributing to mixing in the boundary layer. And so that's what I'm going to go into in the next few slides. And so this,
I mean, you're showing us SST biases, but how do you know how much of that is a bias in the atmospheric boundary layer?
Like yeah, so and that's another good point, is that there's a lot of other parameterizations here, and there's an atmospheric model, and there's a sea ice model, and so this is why we don't necessarily want to take the approach of saying what values of M star and N star should we use to minimize these biases, but instead we want to try to step back and think about things from the physical perspective of what should they be.
And you also, you didn't show us the time series of PE that I noticed with the same way that you did before, but that would have worked regardless of vertical resolution and regardless of time scale with whatever N star and M star. So
yeah,
you
I have
use that to tune me.
I have that slide coming up. And so one question then is, how can we actually figure out what these values of M star and N star should be? And so what, I guess, first of all, I want to make sure the concept of what M star actually is pretty clear. And so basically, M star can include any of the mechanical terms, so the shear instability, wave breaking, perhaps Langmuir turbulence. And it's just giving you the amount of that that goes into this quadrant here. So it's not saying anything about how you change your TKE budget, and it's not saying anything about dissipation. It is just saying how much of these terms contribute to the mixing. And likewise, for N star, it's just saying how much of this term contributes to mixing.
Are they dimensional,
N star? N star and N star are non-dimensional, yeah.
They really are.
And so one nice thing from this equation is, if we think about a case with no surface stress or surface mechanical mixing, we can drop this term out, and we can, sorry, if we think about a case with only U star cubed, so only mechanical mixing, we can drop this term out and rearrange that equation and solve directly for M star if we know this term here. And so if we have a model that we trust, or observations that we trust that we know everything about, we can derive this quantity directly. Similarly for N star, that would be the case where I drop this term out and you can solve for N star. And so the question is, what can we use as a model or an observation or something to find those values? And so I'm going to start with N star. The nice thing about N star is there's a huge literature about how the convective buoyancy flux behaves in the atmosphere. So this was a lot of work back in the 1970s, basically measuring these buoyancy fluxes. And at kind of first order, you can approximate this profile as roughly linear through the boundary layer. And it turns out that it tends to overshoot the zero by a fraction of 0.2, which is kind of an empirical sort of result that's been found many times through history. And so those integrals that I was showing you here are then just the areas of these triangles here. And so if we know roughly this 0.2 factor, and we know this is roughly linear, then we can say that the value of n star is the ratio of the red to the blue, which in this case would be just 0.2 times 0.2 for the top triangle, which is 0.04. And then depending on what you think happens in the bottom triangle, it can either be somewhere between 0 or equal to the top triangle, so roughly a value of 0.06. Which then I can run the K-epsilon simulations and I can solve for...
So it's observation-based, that's atmospheric observation-based.
Yeah. But there's also, I mean, I don't know that anyone has ever tried to observe the buoyancy fluxes in the convective boundary layer in the ocean, but at least purely convective. But this oceanic LES in 2010 found pretty much the exact same result, and there's no reason that the physics should be different.
What's the dependence on HM?
So what am I defining HM as here?
HM is the difference between your
HD and HPL. HM
training,
yeah. Yeah, so I guess these terms would, for the most part, fall out when you're actually, because everything basically scales with everything else because we're just looking at triangles.
You can't choose it anytime.
HM does not scale with HG.
I think it does.
If you have the linear profile, it's an assumption, but if you have the linear profile, then it would in this case.
Does AM1 and AM2 have the same area, or is that...
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's what I give this plus or minus 0.2, where I say AM2 could be 0, it could be equal to AM1, or...
I mean, that's the dependence on HM.
Yeah.
That you choose the area of the second triangle.
So then, to kind of back it up, I also ran these with this K epsilon, the simplified one with these empirical results. So I chose that because a couple LES I've done, it looked pretty good against, and they've also validated against observations in a couple of studies in the late 2000s. So it seemed like a reasonable model to use to run a whole bunch of cases. So instead of actually deploying LES for all these conditions, and so I ran it with a bunch of heat fluxes here and got pretty good agreement with this estimate of n star. So this is now, instead of using the 0.2, we reduce it down to something on the order of 0.06. And so then what about m star? So it turns out, so I started running, you know, a whole bunch of these K-epsilon simulations and trying to figure out what m star would be. And if you just basically compare the value of m star, so in my k epsilon results, I find k from that. I'm assuming it's a known quantity. I take that integral, I divide it by u star cubed, and it actually ends up scaling very well with just the ratio of the Ekman length scale and the boundary layer length scale. And if I run enough simulations for a long enough time, I can find a curve like this red curve here. But it turns out there is a lot of kind of time transience dependence in here, particularly when you excite currents and your TKE production and wind input are in balance. So this means that you have more production than wind input here in the yellow dots. It ends up being pretty high above this red line. And so this is an area that's it's a bit less clear on how to deal with, but for higher latitudes, we tend to fall on this version of the curve, or portion of the curve here. And then how to deal with this part of the curve is still kind of an open question. And it's really the time dependence and the question of how important all that time dependence is in the climate model that lives within what we do here. But I do have an alternative way to deal with it, which I'll get to in a second. Then the question is, what do we do when we have surface heating? And so if you do kind of your Buckingham Pi type analysis, you get these non-dimensional relationships. So this is one of them. You also get a relationship that looks like this, which is just your Oblukoff length squared over your Ekman depth times your boundary layer depth. And so when I plotted all these values of M star just against the HF U star, obviously there's a lot of scatter. But the bottom of that curve tends to behave just as the neutral case did. But if I subtract that part out and then just look at the variability due to the stabilizing stratification, we end up with a curve that matches very well to the that non-dimensional relationship. And so physically what's going on here is that M star has to go up when you have a stabilizing surface flux because you're creating a lot of stable stratification near the surface. And so that stable stratification gets mixed up at a much higher ratio than when the you just have your neutral boundary layer where your stable stratification is mostly at the bottom. And before anyone calls me out on it, I know I haven't addressed F goes to zero yet. I'll get there in a second. The other question is, what about when you have mechanical and buoyancy forcing together? Then I can't just back out M star or N star because they're both active. So instead, the way I looked at it is to see what my scalings would predict relative to what the K epsilon was giving on the Y axis. So this is all, again, I'm just looking at this integrated part of the stabilizing. I call this mixing, and I've been showing this over and over. And you can see when we have the destabilizing heat flux, we end up with more mixing in our model when we assume just the neutral value of M star than we would have gotten, than we get in the K epsilon result. So just thinking about it very kind of simplistically, you realize that what this M star is actually doing is trying to mix up stable stratification. In a convective boundary layer, you have unstable stratification. So you can actually just then take the ratio of the region of unstable stratification to the whole boundary layer depth. And there's a bit of a coefficient in there, but just working from that basic idea, you can correct that extra bit of mixing just by saying that you can no longer contribute to mixing in this part of the boundary layer, so you reduce M star by something roughly proportionally. Okay, so now the equator. At the equator, your time scale changes to the stratification. That's pretty much the only relevant time scale. And it turns out back in the 70s, they already knew this. M star scales very well with basically your buoyancy length scale over your boundary layer depth. But it's not obvious how you would actually transition then between this N-based and F-based scaling. So the other thing I can do is I showed you we had this shear-driven mixing scheme that was designed for use in climate models, so to not have too much time dependence to the mixing. And it works very well at the equator. And so what we're doing for now is instead of trying to think all this through, which I've spent a lot of time on, but I have yet to make the breakthrough on, we're just transitioning to use this scheme at the equator. And so to prove that that works okay, I ran several simulations with this K epsilon, kind of my truth. So each of these white dots, or colored dots, represents a simulation. The x-axis is the heat flux we use at the surface, ranging from destabilizing to stabilizing. and the y-axis is the latitude. And the color here represents the difference in the surface temperature between the simulation with either just that Jackson scheme, just EPBL, where I basically just have to put something so it doesn't blow up when F goes to zero, or something that transitions to using Jackson in the tropics and uses EPBL away from the tropics. And so the top panel is showing you the results with 1 meter resolution and a 1200 second time step, and you can see the combination of the two gives very similar results to what the Capsilon was doing. And you can see that the biases are very clearly complementary. And we can repeat the same thing with a coarser resolution and longer time step and get still pretty reasonable results. And so at this point, we're pretty happy. We felt like this was a nice way to tune the model and then now test it and see what this did to our biases. Oh, before I get there, I also, this is EPBL and how it depends on the resolution and the time step. Obviously, it doesn't consider the mean flow within the parameterization at all. It just includes basically these boundary conditions. And therefore, the resolution dependence is limited to only that little bit about how the boundary layer comes in. And it turns out you can still do that pretty well at all of these cases. So when I ran that in the climate model, then now we get a very different result. Our mean bias is significantly lower. Our boundary layers are now clearly very shallow. And this actually turned out for me to be a good thing, because the reason that I was interested to get into this work was because I was expecting the impact of surface waves and Langmuir turbulence to be important here. And this is a region of the world where we expect to have significant shallow biases when you're not accounting for the effect of ocean waves. And so that's largely because the waves tend to be huge in this region.
But how do you force this model to have high frequency winds?
This model, no. This is, I think, 2 hourly coupling.
You worry about inertial oscillations, right? What? You worry about inertial near-inertial stuff? Yeah. I mean, it depends more on the vertical resolution, too. I mean, there are a lot of masses getting that for right. Well, it's just that I think theoreticians are forgetting that theoretically the southern ocean, the only issue you see is inertia, and it's huge. So if you don't resolve that, well, everything else is a bit irrelevant. I,
if you have high resolution gaps, you have to get there. This is, I think, 100 kilometer. So.
2 degree atmosphere.
Just, this is the, that was the coupled model, right? The coupled.
Yes, this is coupled. So yeah, so there's a lot of other stuff going on in here, but this is why we kind of back up and use this one-dimensional model to try to get it.
Clarify. Yeah. There's a question about the wind driving. The wind is calculated.
Yes.
Online.
So what's missing?
Before you go into your favorite subject, I'm struck by your using K epsilon as a standard. I don't think most of the turbulence community would accept that.
So, well, I think, I mean, what do you propose as an alternative? Are you thinking like a Mellor-Yamada style, or do you think an LES is where you have to be?
I mean, at the risk of provoking, for sure, John Lumley convened a conference in 1991 to bury second-order local closure models.
So,
although he gave it a very nice eulogy.
I guess the reason that I have chosen to go this way is because it tended to, I did just a couple comparisons against large eddy simulations, and I'll actually show you that these scalings are also compared against large eddy simulations later on, and it tended to work surprisingly well. So instead of running large eddy simulations for all of these cases.
I understand the economic problem.
Yeah. I mean, in principle, you can rederive M star and N star relationships from whatever your preferred truth is. And I can certainly allow the fact that the K epsilon is not necessarily the truth. It is just my chosen truth here.
But I mean, the amazing thing is that you have all of the potential complexity of the K epsilon and you don't have a time step or a resolution limitation at all. But
right.
That's the target.
Yeah.
That's satisfied.
Yeah. So what's missing? So one thing that we think is missing is surface waves. And so I think there's been a bit of discussion about these wave mean flow interaction equations and how you get the derive the Craig-Leibovitz equations and everything. And so I'm not going into any details of those actual equations today. But what I am going to do is just show some results of a model that includes that complexity and show how we can modify EPBL to reproduce the results of the model that does include that complexity. And so if you're not familiar with the concept of Langmuir circulations, they're basically the effect of the wave-averaged Stokes drift. So that is the fact that your ocean surface waves tend to not have these closed orbital structures that we kind of think of when we're first introduced to them, but actually have a net drift. And that net drift has a vertical shear to it. And when you derive the equations in a special way, that vertical shear Stokes drift combines with the background Eulerian current to modify the turbulence field. And so in some senses, it enhances the amount of turbulence, but it also modifies the ways that that turbulence actually goes into mixing versus dissipation and how it's fluxed through the water column. And it's quite complicated when you start to think of it in its total detail. So I'm going to stay away from most of that today. But what I am showing, and sorry, I don't have any color bars in here, but this is two simulations. So these are simulations that Ching has provided me, where he initialized the large eddy simulation with, I think, a 40-meter mixed layer and then stable stratification below. And he forced it with constant winds, and then he varied the buoyancy flux in these simulations. This is a case with very little buoyancy flux. And he also varied the Stokes drift in these simulations. And so this case has no Stokes drift. And I'm showing you this quantity that I've been talking about a lot today, this integrated mixing against stable stratification. And the color bar is the same for these two figures, and so is the x and y axes. And so the main point is that you can see how the Langmuir turbulence really enhances the mixing and the entrainment in the water column. And so this is something that we want to be able to add. What am I? I'm at an hour? Yeah.
The color indicated what? I'm sorry.
Yeah. The color, so black is no mixing. It's this integral of W prime B prime bar. And so basically this just tells you that you have a lot more potential energy being created. So here is a plot I like to show, because the first thing I'm going to point out is that what I'm comparing is the prediction of the EPBL on the y-axis to the value we get back from the large eddy simulation on the x-axis. And the color bar indicates the Langmuir number, where the red points basically have weak waves or no Langmuir impact, and the bluer colors have stronger Langmuir impact. And so what we see is that our scalings actually agree very well with the large eddy simulation when the waves aren't important. So this helps to justify the use of the K-epsilon scaling. But the other thing you really notice is that we miss a lot of important mixing when there are stronger wave conditions. And so the way that I have gone at this is just to introduce an additional M star term for the Langmuir turbulence and to try to figure out what that should be and what it should depend on. And so this is quite similar to the derivation of the traditional bulk mix layer, where you have your wind input term, you have your wave breaking term, and you have your dissipation term, and those are all wrapped into M star. So now we're just adding one more source term.
And is M star LT a constant, or that's a function of Stokes drift?
It will be a function of Stokes drift, yes. So and actually some other quantities, as you guys have also found. So one
so
kind
in
of...
your, well outside my expertise, but in your previous slide, you talked about the Langmuir turbulence affecting PE production, right? Or affecting vertical mixing, but here it's all in a dissipation term, isn't it? It's all...
So I am not looking at dissipation at all. In all of these, I'm looking at potential energy production.
Sorry. All right. So maybe I misunderstood what the two terms, your original description of the two terms. So go on and we can talk.
These are all, everything is making proportional to the potential energy production term. So the dissipation term is pretty much wrapped up into the difference between the production. This value is the difference between the production and the dissipation. And so one thing we can look at is we can look at how these integrals vary in time in different conditions. And so I'm just showing, so he ran a suite of about 15 to 20 cases, and I'm just showing four cases here where I isolated a case with strong wind and strong cooling, weak wind, and heating. And I plot both the Langmuir turbulence case and the no Langmuir turbulence case, and look at the difference in the potential energy production term. And so in a lot of the previous parameterizations, it wasn't as clear if there should be an effect of the surface buoyancy flux on how much the Langmuir turbulence affects the mixing. But one thing we found is since they're both producing a lot of strong vertical motion, there is a lot of interaction between them. And you can see when we have strong cooling, the difference between the Langmuir and non-Langmuir is significantly smaller, at least the ratio. So these color y-axes are not the same. But the strong wind case certainly shows a significantly greater enhancement. And these are quite similar to the results that Ching and Baylor found in their study, basically analyzing this from the perspective of KPP. So the question is then, how do I get that M star LT term? And so what I'm going to assume is that I can isolate the Langmuir contribution to the total mixing. So this is, again, that integral of the potential energy production term. This is the total, so this is what I calculate from the LES. These two terms are the version of EPBL I was showing before, basically the shear and the buoyancy contributions. And the leftover bit is what the Langmuir turbulence is doing. And so there's some complexities about how you relate this MLT to a Langmuir number, which is a non-dimensional, did I show it? It's basically the ratio of the surface forcing to the Stokes drift forcing. For here, I'm just using a Langmuir number that assumes that this Stokes drift should be averaged over 20% of the boundary layer, which is what several recent studies have showed. And then the question is just what the functional form should be and what it should consider. And so in the top, I'm only showing a case where we scale it by the Langmuir number. And you can see there's a lot of scatter. So this this is basically the functional fit I would come up with to best reduce the scatter to try to get that one-to-one line, just considering Langmuir number. And then in the bottom is when I also include ratio of the Ekman and Obukhov length scale. So that's actually the absolute value of the Obukhov length scale. And so clearly, that length scale term is important. But I don't have the details of that shape here.
Sorry, can I ask, because the fact that it scales on and off, isn't that suggesting that it's not a linear superposition, that there is some nonlinear coupling?
So there should be some interaction between the various contributions to the turbulence, but I guess this was just kind of a first order way to try to back out the extra bit of mixing due to Langmuir turbulence. And the other thing I should point out is that this isn't necessarily the mixing due to Langmuir turbulence. This is just the extra mixing that you would see if there were not Langmuir turbulence. So you can reduce this term in the presence of Langmuir turbulence, but this term then takes up that difference. And so here I'm just considering the difference between that and the value you would assume for this without Langmuir turbulence. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's...
What is the form of F?
Sorry, I didn't put it on this slide here, but it's similar to what a lot of the traditional scalings, where you can come up with basically relationships between your enhancements of Langmuir number to the minus 2. Here, this is actually with Langmuir number to the minus 1 that I find a linear relationship.
Do you use a cutoff for a small Langmuir number?
In the model, I do. In this plot here, I didn't do anything. And so when I include that additional term, you can see then we're able to recover the correct amount of mixing in this new framework compared to what the LES gets. And so we can plug that into the model now, and we start to do quite a bit better on boundary layer depths. And our SST biases are reasonable, and obviously there's a lot of other sub-parameterizations that are going on here that I'm not talking about. And so if you would like to point out my equatorial bias, I haven't gotten an email from Alistair about it yet today, but
most days I do.
Can I ask, maybe I missed something, where do you get US from?
In this model?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this I'm actually using another result of Ching's where he relates it to the wind speed, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. Their study basically showed that when you actually run the coupled model and resolve the waves, and when you use this basically wind speed dependent, but with some enhancement in the Southern Ocean, more or less, I think the way it happens, in my doing it justice.
Yeah, so it's basically just use some empirical wave spectrum to come up with the relation between the storm strip and the wind.
And does it have a seasonal and spatial dependence, or what?
Yeah, depends on the wind. And there's another factor.
It's a function of the wind. It's just a more complicated function of the wind.
This is the longstanding conception of equilibrium wind waves under steady-ish winds and long fetch.
No, it's not, though, because it's not trained against equilibrium states. It's trained against wave watch. So it's a non-equilibrium state, but it has similar scaling laws to the equilibrium behavior. So it's a statistical representation of the lack of equilibrium.
But the statistical, so all you need to know is wind, or do you apply some spatial now, or some kind of seasonal now?
I'm surprised.
All you need is wind. That's it. Yes.
That's when you need to compute the
factor.
Right. So when you have to apply this.
Okay. Yes. So you get the full profile, and then you can integrate over whatever your mixed layer depth is.
But I mean, this is also to say that Langmuir is a very insensitive metric of how well you have measured Stokes drift. The other major result from this paper, Ching's, is that you can really hammer the. How badly you estimate Stokes drift, you still do okay in this metric. And so you don't have to do a good job to get the Langmuir number right enough to drive a parameterization of mixing. That's the simplest.
That's on topic for this talk, but I'm distracted off topic. Are you really claiming that there's a universal relation between wind speed and Stokes drift that does not depend on wave age?
I don't think that's true because.
I don't think
but
that's true.
There's a.
So we have two.
We have a
So it is true?
Middle temperature true, it's really right there.
Let's take another, but non.
Doesn't have to be that, let's do this. That's the important, that's an important point. This is a very, it's seeing it through a very blurry lens, whether or not you got the Stokes drift right.
And so they did it in their study, and they showed that it was pretty much the same when they had the full coupling and not to leading order. And so then I actually tested it in an offline run, so not this version, but with core forcing and with waves that I simulated there, and I pretty much found the same thing that they did. So for our operational needs, it's obviously significantly cheaper to do it this way, and it seems to at least get most of the effect in there that we want to get in there.
And fine, I'm not arguing this dull metric, but I'd be curious to see this discussed from a surface wave spectrum perspective.
Okay. Yeah, is it going to have any non-local effects? I mean, these swells are going to be generated and move away from the wind source region.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, that still the effect of getting all of that in there is, I guess it's still an open question about when and where all that's important for this. I mean, if you want to predict the exact wave height that you're going to have in 100 years, don't use the results of this.
if you want to go swimming in winter off this coast, don't use this.
Yeah.
But the main effect is that when you have more wind, you get more waves, and this part gets that part right, and it also has a higher order correction beyond that. And so it is not ridiculously bad way to get it.
Would you like to
bathe a little swim?
I just think that Ching can talk about it next week, but we'll have to find the time.
And so I just have a final slide here with some of the future work, just thinking more about this cost benefit between the parameterizations. One of the key questions is at what time and space resolution should we use what parameterization, or shouldn't the parameterization work across all scales? I guess that's the ultimate goal. And do all these parameterizations capture typical ocean conditions, which is one thing we're kind of looking into a lot right now with some of these Gautam runs that Ching's also been organizing here, with basically core 2 forcing all over the planet, simulated wave fields, and all these different boundary layer schemes, so we can see where they're similar, where they're different, and get at that question of what is the best truth and when. Or maybe we won't get at the question of what the best truth is, but how well do they all agree, at least. Obviously, I mentioned some of the areas where I'm still thinking about how we can improve the CPBL framework. Is the non-gradient mixing important in a climate model? And what about non-gradient momentum mixing? And work left to do on Langmuir parameterization, as we've been discussing now a bit. But we didn't actually get at this point where should you mix down the gradient of the Stokes drift in a climate model?
So you mean like non-local transport in KPP, is that what you mean by non-gradient, or what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I like to call it non-gradient because...
Yeah, so you don't have any of that?
No. No, and...
So Jim, are you going to complain?
Well, Jim Deardorff, if he were still alive, would complain.
Yeah, non-gradient mixing is definitely important in convection. I will not try to dispute that fact, but is that slight change to the temperature profile that you get, which kind of rectifies that buoyancy flux, important? I don't necessarily know.
That somehow prompts the remark that if we're talking about sort of gross and sensitive metrics, well then climate modeling is
a gross metric.
Yeah, which comes back to the
All right.
I have a second question. I thought Noah was not supposed to have climate in their slides anymore.
I work for Princeton.
That's DOE.
key to the whole thing was getting used to that, right? And so it comes from the atmosphere. So if the atmospheric model's wrong, there's no way you can get U star.
Yeah, right. So we assume in all of this that we have U star right. Which, of course, then brings questions about, is the atmosphere right? Do you know the transfer coefficient?
So the Langley-Toothless model, as suggested, might be perfect, but the atmospheric model might be wrong.
Yeah. That's what, every time somebody shows a coupled model bias reduction, it's not mainly whatever field it is you have optimized that's causing the effect.
So you split the room between atmosphere people and ocean air.
Well, there's ice people. So half of these problems are probably ice.
We haven't seen any ice people from yet.
Hey, this is why I work in a big building. I hope that the atmospheric people are making their improvements at the same time.
One other comment, going back, which followed up from Paul, which was Coriolis, and you sort of said you'd really lump that into your mean velocity. Well, why not bring that in more explicitly in those models?
So I guess there are some higher order closures that do consider how that might affect.
KPP from the beginning has considered a Coriolis limitation.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to limit your boundary layer depth by the Ekman depth, that's one way. But in these higher order schemes, they actually include it when they start parameterizing their second turbulent moment and third turbulent moment, so you can get those rotational terms in there. And I should also mention that in the version of N star, there's some observational studies that show that the potential energy release actually reduces as you go down due to rotational effects. And so we can include things like that as well. But and then it starts to be a question of which components of Coriolis are important too. Do you need just the vertical component, or is the horizontal component also relevant to the turbulent stuff?
So I have kind of maybe a bit more of a broader question, or maybe a philosophical question. So I think one of the main things that you're describing here is having your parameterization give the same results at different resolutions. And again, I'm not an expert on this, but I was chatting to someone else who also knows nothing about this, and I made a claim that there exists some parameterizations where to get it to accurately model some physical phenomena, you need one set of parameters, and then to get say like weather timescales versus climate timescales, you need another set of parameters in order to get the best match. And I always thought that this was a little bit disconcerting, and this guy was a physicist, and he says, well, of course you have to change the parameters because you have the running of the coupling constants. So his claim was that you might be able to come up with some self-consistent way of actually predicting how to change your parameters and your parameterization when you are changing your resolution. And that the fact that you need to, the fact that just picking one value, like 0.15 or whatever it is, and then changing resolution, that you get different results. Maybe that's expected, and that there's like a different way to think about the problem where you don't have that issue anymore. Is Brad here?
I can respond to that.
No.
There's two different. There are a couple of different distinctions. One is whether that coefficient is acting as some parameterization of something that's changing as you change resolution. So weather versus climate, if you're having different coupling timescales, you might actually be representing different physics, even though it may have the same scaling, resolved or unresolved. The most pressing version of that is when you're transitioning between a Reynolds average, very large scale, scale separated, small scale turbulence, large scale model, and a model where some of the turbulence is resolved, the large eddy simulation. The large eddy scaling always should depend on your resolution.
Right.
The Reynolds average probably don't.
Okay.
But that's not always the case.
Okay. So the claim is that these types of parameterizations for use in these types of models, you really think that the numbers in the parameterizations should just be numbers.
Yeah.
And not change when you
should. Four turbulent boundary layers at the top and the bottom.
Okay.
Yes. And so there should be grid resolution within those boundary layers because there are profiles within those boundary layers.
So as long as you're resolving the profile, you should have the same answer regardless of how you change the resolution. When you get coarser than that, if you don't have even a grid point in the boundary layer, they go crazy. That's not the limit we need.
So initially, so you have this expression of the key, but you have this m star and u star cubed. So what is the logic for having u star cubed as a source of TK? Because you're trying to say that the shear turbulence plus wave is everything, but the wave turbulence can actually be much bigger than that. And because it can dissipate near the surface, so I don't see how it makes logic to lump them together in the first place. And actually, in the end, the way you do it with this m star LT is like separating them again. So.
Yeah, so I haven't actually explicitly considered any wave breaking term in what I've done today.
So you're not doing Dirichlet cycle and shallow wave layer stuff?
I mean, it's so. I guess our first grid cell, we've always kind of made the argument that the first grid cell basically is where all the wave stuff happens, the production and the dissipation anyways. Our grid cells are starting to get down on the order of 2 meters, so when you have large significant wave heights, it's possible that that's no longer true. And so there is some question about if we are missing some important effects due to breaking waves in here. And in this framework, that would sit, so the original way that these were written, it was basically like m star equals an m1, which is the wind term, plus an m2, which is the wave term, minus an md, which is the dissipation. So you could put my mlt inside of this m star the way that I've done it as well. I just keep it separate right now because that's keeping it the more traditional m star part out. And then, yeah, so the question of why the shear mixing scales so well with U star cubed instead of, for example, a wind input term, which is.
You would expect to have a C bar time, the U star squared, doesn't matter.
In all the simulations I've been looking at, it's the U star cubed that collapses it, and I'm not actually sure what terms are canceling to let that happen. Yeah.
So I'm just noticing that you're plotting the summer mixed layer depth. Is that the northern hemisphere summer?
So it's, no, this is summer in both hemispheres.
Okay. Is that just because
it's
there's
January and August?
Just wondering what the northern hemisphere would look like because our mixed layers get very deep in the western boundary currents.
So yeah, I could have also plotted the winter mixed layer depths. But there's less of an influence of these M star and Langmuir turbulence effects on those. So that's why I've highlighted these terms today. And I think since I don't have the plots in front of you, I can claim they're good. But I think they are pretty good.
Okay, before we read these, so people who've been doing the journal club, is there a journal club's reading scheduled for next week yet?
Well,
I was just going to suggest that Ching, if you want to talk about the theory wave, that would be a good time to do it.
Yeah. So what we're discussing about to have, but I'm just not sure what it
is. Is that a Friday?
It is Friday. Well, then we'll make
it work.
The theory wave paper. Yeah, we could do that. You could do the theory wave paper, but we need to talk to Jim about it. We'll do that separately. But that would be good.
So you're saying that journal club a week from this Friday it's going to be like open, no juniors journal club.
Well, no, I was just going to suggest that Ching could have an opportunity to present and we don't have to add an extra. If we're right up against the conference, I would say, oh, let's just go to the next week, but we're going to forget all this conversation by the 2 weeks, 3 weeks out. So I was think since we already have a scheduled soft spot, maybe that would work. Okay.